Yes, and I called Mary Ellen Lee McBride up and I said, you're only freelancing now, you don't work steadily in the newspaper world right now, and could you suggest somebody, because I know you're head of the Women's Press Club, who could give us a very good lecture on Jane Grey Swisshelm, the famous Pittsburgh newspaper woman? Oh, she says, I just love her, she's just part of history, and I'm sure I can get someone, let me call you back. So she called me back in a week, and she said, Leonore, you're not going to believe this. I talked to 7 women. They all were pleased to be asked, and everyone said they didn't know enough that they dared to give such a lecture. So I, knowing her background, she is a DAR, and her family came originally from Philadelphia across the Alleghenies. They were a printer's family, and then they came to Western Pennsylvania. I said to her, Mary Ellen, why don't you do it? You love her the way I do. Why don't you do the lecture? And she said, you know, I think I will. Well, I can tell you, very briefly, it was one of the outstanding lectures. It was so good, I got her 2 paid speaking engagements at 2 different clubs, and she is now in the process of getting ready to write her book on Jane Grey Swisshelm.
That's very interesting.
As a matter of fact, 4 books have come out of the lecture series.
I see.
And we feel that's pretty seminal,
that's wonderful.
If you ask me.
That's great.
And I can tell you many more of them, but I don't know how much of that you'll want.
Anything that you're interested in telling us, we'll
then just stop there, because this way I can always...
National Council of Jewish Women, 3rd interview with Leonore Elkis, Tuesday, October 25th. Let's see how it comes. Third interview with Leonore Elkis, Tuesday, October 25th. To 1983. To continue our discussion of the famous men and women of Pittsburgh, Mrs. Elkis, we had talked about Jane Grey Swisshelm, the newspaper woman, and how Mary McBride was attempting to get someone to do the lecture who was knowledgeable and finally ended up doing it herself and was highly successful.
Yes, she was so successful that she told me after I'd suggested her name for 2 other lectures at 2 clubs, College Club and the 20th Century Club, that she called me and said, I'm writing a book about her myself, and it looks as if that book will be published either this winter still in 83 or in 84. And the interesting thing about the lecture series is that a number of books came out because of it. One was Dr. Kathleen Byrne, who with Dr. Snyder wrote a book called Chrysalis, now completely sold out, which was about Willa Cather's Pittsburgh Years, which was one of her, that was her lecture, if you remember. And that has been sold out, and I think they're not yet sure where they will reprint it. So that was another book. And still another book came out of Dr. Wallace Beardsley's lecture, which was excellent, on Samuel Pierpont Langley, the astronomer and inventor, who, if you recall, was the man who developed the Langley Wind Tunnel, which still exists in Virginia, without which we wouldn't have present aerodynamics. And Dr. Langley, who had been here for a number of years, head of our astronomical laboratory, Dr. Beardsley, got his PhD at Pitt for his research in Langley, and then has written a book, which I do not know when it will be out, but it'll probably be out sometime this year or next year, and I'm sure he'll let us all know. And that was another book. So when you figure, there was Chrysalis by Dr. Byrne. There was the book on Samuel Langley that's going to come out within a year, I would assume, and the one on Jane Grey Swisshelm, which is coming out. And there was my book on the lecture series itself, which was requested by the joint committees of the City of Pittsburgh and Pittsburgh History and Landmarks Foundation. So this is, I think, to me, very rewarding, that some of the very people did write books about the lectures that have proved, I would say, quite successful.
In other words, it was the impetus for them going on to
yes,
the more.
Yes, I really think it was, yes.
Could I ask, what criteria did you use in selecting people to contribute to this?
I'm glad you asked that, because I spent a great deal of time before I even went to my good friend William Oliver and to several other friends in Pittsburgh and said, what do you think of these selections? What I tried to do, having come from another city myself, was to think, how many Pittsburghers really know about some of these people that I had found so fascinating when, if you recall, I mentioned the fact that I tried to study something about Pittsburgh when I first came here. And I chose people that I thought had been extremely creative, even if they later went somewhere else. But they had done creative work in this city, and that they were people of real stature in their fields. Now, of course, there are many more we couldn't do, and I knew them, and I'm sure my board knew them. But those I chose, I felt, had a particular value to this area. And it seems that I've been corroborated by the response. And the most recent response came last summer, just before I went on holiday, when I received a letter from Princeton, from a professor there in research, who asked for permission to use a good bit of the material about the labor leaders that had been done, if you recall, it was about, supposedly about Golden and Murray, but yeah, was more about Murray, but which was done by by I.W. Abel, who, if you recall, was the head of the Steelworkers Union for many years in Pittsburgh. And he wanted the permission, which of course I couldn't give him alone because it was the property of Pittsburgh History Landmarks Foundation, but they were delighted to give him permission to quote from that article on the proviso that he would give, of course, the source, which of course he's promised to do in writing. And this, of course, shows that perhaps our choices weren't too bad as we covered the waterfront, so to speak.
As you mentioned, there were so many to select from. Might you one day do a sequel, do you think?
Well, one of the members of the board who has been perhaps more supportive of the board, both financially and culturally, than almost anyone else, mentioned it might be possible to do one or two of those types of lectures a year. Mm-hmm. And I have not yet considered that nor pushed that any further, but it was nice that that was the feeling of the whole board. And I can't say that I really had the time to do any more this year because of many personal things that have come up. And of course they are quite interested and quite willing to look at any suggestions I have about rewriting some of them for children. Is my choice, it would have to be, and then they could be made much simpler, and those that would relate best to children, and children could relate best to the topic and the person. And that I might still be able to do, but I, again, have not been able to get started on it at the moment.
Well, that would be an interesting adaptation, I thought.
Yes, and I believe the board would go along with it, and that we could probably find some funding to do it. We hope that it would go into the public schools. It would not be for the foundation. We would like to see, since American history and our history too could of course stand a good amount of updating and color, I think, we hope that if we ever do it, that maybe a foundation or two would help underwrite the little booklets which would go into the schools of Pittsburgh and Allegheny County. So that's something to think about.
When we were discussing your activities with WQED, you mentioned something about producing some documentaries,
yes,
which we didn't discuss at the moment. Could you tell us something about
yes,
these?
Well, you see, besides my regular shows, occasionally I would find a topic that I thought had very real value for the community, and then I would do a documentary. And frankly, without looking up my records, which are stored far away, I can't remember them all. I can think of a few. I think I was, frankly, the first person in Allegheny County who did a documentary on old age. And that was well received, very well received. And we got a lot of calls, because this will maybe amuse you. My opening shot was a shot of a used car lot piled high with cars. And the man who was our speaker, who sort of gave the descriptive intervals, and then we had different authorities speaking about it, and we went to the different hospitals and homes. His first words were, "Senior citizens or older people in our country are frequently scrapped, just like the old cars that you see here. When they're beyond a certain age, our society doesn't seem to have place." Words to that effect. And I'm sure right after that show was shown the first time, I think it was shown several times, that board lit up, and there were so many irate older people on the phone saying, "No, they're not treated like scrap cars." Well, we never heard from all those who felt that it was a good analogy, but we heard from those who didn't, and we were glad there were enough that they would do so. We were delighted. That was one. Then I believe I was probably the first person in this area who did a documentary on mixed marriages between blacks and whites. And that was quite well received.
I'd say you were a pioneer in both areas.
Well, I don't know, but it was my suggestion. I had the approval of the program director, so I could do them. It took a lot of work, and I had to have a lot of contacts, because some people, of course, didn't want to be quoted or didn't want to be on camera. Others didn't mind. I was very happy that there were a number who were willing to be on and talk about what the good things and the problems had been. And let me see. Oh, those two strike me.
So did you direct this and write it?
Oh, yeah. And took a lot of time and a lot of research. But I thought it was those subjects were coming up more and more in life, and I thought perhaps we should do something.
Time has certainly proven me right.
And I did a documentary on Lee Diddley, who is, I think, one of the best Pittsburgh primitive artists we've had, and he is a good friend of mine. He's now in his 80s, and we went out, and he walked around with us and talked about his beloved South Side, and we showed pictures of, we showed reproductions, rather, or photographs of his paintings of the South Side. We called it Lee Diddley's Love Affair with the South Side. And this wonderful old gentleman, who's now in his 80s, was then about maybe 72 or 3. And he's one of the finest human beings I've ever known. Until he became quite ill, he sang in his church choir every single Sunday. And he was then in his 70s. And he lived in the home, and was over 100 years old, that his father and mother had had, right on the edge of a hill, and he's still living in it now. He had started, as John Payne had, as a house painter. And then I found some of his paintings very worthwhile, and he's had several exhibits, and he still does some painting, though he isn't well anymore and has to take it a little easier. So that was one I was particularly pleased to do. And there were quite a number of others, and all of them on topics, I think, that were at least very much in the changing picture of our society.
Do you have any present role with WQED?
No, none now. No, I still have some friends over there and hear from them occasionally, or have to call them about something that I want to know. But I don't have any connection with them now.
And this is the Office for Your Services, altogether as a volunteer?
No, I was paid later in when I'd been there quite a number of years, a small amount.
Mm-hmm.
But most of it was volunteer in the beginning, and without, you know, the first 3 or 4 years, I was more than that, I guess. The first 6 or 7, I was purely volunteer.
I know that you were an active volunteer in many community and civic organizations. perhaps we could talk a little about them. Could we begin with Planned Parenthood Association, Allegheny County?
Well, I was in there. I first went in there in the beginning when it was very small.
What year was that again?
Oh, a couple of years after I came here, about 1936 or 7. Mm-hmm. And I joined them as a volunteer, and in about a year or two they asked me to go on the board as a director, and I did. And then I ended up as a vice president over there. And I started their Speakers Bureau Board, which was made up of board members, and we covered the waterfront as far as where we would go and what we talk about. For instance, the doctors would talk about medical aspects of it to more medical groups or to community groups that wanted a doctor. And those of us who were lay members of the community tried to speak about the need for it and the fact that most people do want to limit their children in order to give them the better opportunities. And if that was true then, how true it is today with the unbelievable rising costs of raising a child and giving them the best opportunity educationally that we can. And it was interesting, a personal sidelight. Many of these talks I gave had to be given at night. And my husband would not permit me to go at night, even then when things were probably a lot safer than they were now. You know, Pittsburgh's a community of many small towns, and it's easy to get lost. You've all done it, and you're right here, so you know. So he would go along even on some of the worst nights that ever were. And he would take along his newspapers and sit there. He wouldn't even go in the halls. I remember speaking before a group of miners and their wives and all kinds of groups. And he would wait, bless his soul, until it was finished, and then get me home. I think that was love beyond duty. Really. I really do. But it was interesting, the different types of groups, because in those days it was a far less accepted idea. And of course there was always the fear that our very good Mayor Lawrence might close us down. And I remember Mrs. William Thaw, the old lady, who was just something terrific, a little silver-haired, five-foot lady with sparkling blue eyes, and she said, just let them shut us down. I can't wait to go in a paddy wagon. And you never heard the board how they roared, and they all said, well, Mrs. Thaw, if you go, all of us will go with you, I really promise. But luckily, that never happened.
Did you run into a lot of opposition from church groups?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. There was not church groups, but mostly one church group, mm-hmm. of course. But this is to be expected. And the need was there, and we grew and grew and grew.
Are you affiliated at present at all?
Yes. I'm sort of, what do you call it, emeritus. Life member, they call me.
I see.
I am a life member.
I see.
Because of some of the work I did there.
I noticed that you were on the board of the Pittsburgh Economic Council. What was the nature of this?
The idea was, I believe it had been started by Mr. William Ray, and he was president of the Board of Education. And the idea was that it was a shame that our public schools did not have enough knowledge or ways to lecture and give young people some idea of our economic system. And the idea was that we should do this because so many jobs and so much of the life of the country was an economic life. So they got together a committee of all kinds of people, professors of various universities, bankers, corporation executives, some of us in media and so forth, in order to hope you could push this and get more teachers trained to work out something with the schools. And it worked out pretty well. I'm sorry it seems to have been dropped, but for a while it was helping to make the young people more aware of how we function, and I hope they'll do more of that in the future.
So this is not really existing today?
Not that
saying.
I know of.
I see.
I don't.
Then there was the Pennsylvania Board of the National Council on Crime and Delinquency.
Yes, well, I was on that board for about 6 years.
Who was governor at that time?
I think part of the time, if I can remember right, was it Scranton? It may have been.
I see.
I'm not positive. I can tell you this, that their ideas were excellent. I enjoyed the national meetings. They were well aware of many of the problems, which have, of course, gotten worse since when I was on this statewide board. But I think one of the things I learned from it, as a rather discouraging but very important thing, which I hope most people who work for a community will remember, you can come up with the greatest ideas and recommendations, and if the legislature passes it in the state, any state, but doesn't implement it with funds, those wonderful ideas remain on the books, unused and unimplemented. And I think this happens far too often. And to me, that was really one of the disappointing things of the crime. We have some excellent laws on the book and no money to
implement it. Is there still such a board?
Oh, yes, I think so. There's one in every state.
I see.
Because it's a national organization.
I see.
But I know we haven't done what was then legislated, and I felt this was a terribly disappointing thing.
The Board of Pittsburgh History and Landmark Foundation.
Well, you know I'm still on that.
Yes,
and that
yes.
I'm very, very interested in keeping what is left. I want to say here that Barbara Hofstadt, Mrs. Henry Hofstadt, she and Charles Arnsberg Jr., without them we wouldn't even have this board. Unfortunately, as they themselves agree, it should have been started 10 years before it was. It's 20 years old now. It should have been started 30 or 35 years before, because during that interval when we had none, and we're not the only city that didn't, we lost some marvelous buildings and structures that under our present aegis we probably could have saved. We were extremely fortunate in the man we got to be the main director and president, Arthur Ziegler. He has twice been asked to be the head of the National Trust, which of course is the national group that tries to preserve buildings and houses and so forth that are part of our heritage. And he has refused because he feels that he's happiest here and that he can still have an influence nationally. People come to see him all the time and ask for his advice and help in preservation. And since he's been here, any number of groups in Pennsylvania, particularly in Western Pennsylvania, have come to our group and asked for Ziegler's help in either starting a group of their own or to help preserve a building that they felt was important. So that we have not only a very good board representing almost everyone in the community, but we have a remarkable man, and now he has taken over more work over at Station Square, and we have a very fine young woman named Dr. Ferguson, who is the director in chief, really, of the main old post office building, which is the headquarters still of Pittsburgh History and Landmarks.
Are there any other community involvements that in the past that you'd care to note? We've just listed a few. They were so numerous.
Well, there were many different ones, and I think you've mentioned a good many of them. Probably I can think of others, but it isn't that important.
I see.
I guess.
Aside from Pittsburgh History and Landmarks, what are your present commitments in the Pittsburgh community?
Nothing special. I do different things as they come up and try to continue with some of the work that I'm still doing.
To turn to another phase, I note that your hobbies were antiques, particularly American and amethyst glass, and gardening, raising dahlias and gladiolas for shows.
That's right.
You continue in this?
Well, I don't do as much showing as I used to because I can't do as much gardening as I used to because I've got arthritis in my knees. But I still have flowers and enjoy them. When you've proved yourself, you know, and gotten the ribbons, you don't really care if you can't do it anymore. It doesn't bother me a bit. But I still enjoy antiquing. I not only look for my own self, but my daughter likes American bluegrass. I can look for her. And I have a sister who has a magnificent collection of Crown Derby. And I look for her, I might say, very unsuccessfully. I told her I think she has most of it. But you can find very little amethyst glass, too, today. It's very interesting. I don't know if this will interest you, if either of you are antiques buffs, but I came into it because when I first came here, some of my friends would say, would you like to go to an auction, country auction usually? And I went with them. At that time, I had no idea of collecting glass. But I would find a pretty piece that I thought I could use for flower arrangements. And I would buy it. And then when I redecorated a room in my house, I bought an Atterbury duck, an amethyst apple. I didn't know a thing about it. But it was the right color accent for a gray and pink room, a bedroom. And I got hooked. And amethyst glass was one of my, well, I love purple. And I didn't find out for a number of years until my mother came out one year and saw the collection. She said, did you know your father loved purple so much? And he died when I was 12.
I see.
So I don't think it had ever come up. No, I had no idea. But he did. And I've enjoyed collecting this. I don't have much opportunity to get it anymore because I have found that most of the families that formerly would have put it on the market, particularly in country auctions, because they knew nothing or anything that wasn't foreign, European or Oriental, couldn't be much good. It was their grandmother. This had all changed since Winterthur, the DuPonts, and Williamsburg, that the Rockefellers had put together. And now people who had colored glass from their families usually kept it, or if they sold it, they sold it usually to some very clever dealer who would come to the house after a death or a dismantlement and say, look, I'll buy it all for a good sum, so it didn't come up in the auctions. So it's very hard to get it now, which is just as good because the prices have also gone up and it's almost prohibitive. But the only thing else I can tell you about it is that when I began, I couldn't afford, even then, the prices of blown glass, so that only a small percentage of my own collection is blown. But I liked the pieces that were pressed. And in those days, they were not very expensive, and I could buy them. And now they are reaching pretty astronomical levels, and I guess I'll be not collecting very much longer. That's the way it is.
Could we return briefly to your children for a moment, Mrs. Alpus? I think you told us that Christopher and John were both in banking.
Yes.
And Peggy is a music therapist here in Pittsburgh.
Yes, and an assistant professor of music therapy.
Oh, where?
And she was at Duquesne.
I see.
Until this past year when Reaganomics terminated her position because she didn't have tenure, but she's still working towards her doctorate. She has her MA in the field of counseling. And at Pitt, and doing clinical work, and this is still her field.
Are any of your children married?
Yes, both the boys are married.
And have you any grandchildren?
One, and two step-grandchildren. My oldest son, Christopher, has two step-grandchildren, and my own grandson, James Montague Elkis, and he's 9 years of age. And as you can probably guess, a great favorite of his grandmother.
I can see the smile.
He lives in New York, and I wish he didn't live so far away, though I realize I'm lucky he might live in another country as my other son does, who's married. He's just been transferred to Switzerland, and he's going to be moving there early in November in Zurich for a city corps. And my other son, Christopher, the father of James, he's Senior Vice President of Fiduciary Trust in New York.
Could we contrast the way you were raised with the way your children and grandchildren are raised, as far as limits set and values?
That's an interesting question. I would say, by and large, that most of what we wanted to give our children was taken from the standards we were raised with. and that it was harder to do it because everything was changing, but we were very conscious of certain things and we did our best to give them to ours. For example, the children were not allowed to watch television during the week unless it was a special program that in some way we felt would add to what they were learning in school. They just were not allowed. And that we felt was very important. And they could watch what they wanted on weekends. And since they were given that freedom, after a while, sure, they'd like it. But they didn't watch all the time. There were too many other things they wanted to do, thank goodness. Another thing was we still believed in manners, and we insisted they have them. And then all three children, even though one has made it a career, my daughter, were brought up with good music in their home.